Unseen Diversity, Lecture 13, Diverse Metabolisms.
In this lecture, I continue to tell you about diverse bacterial metabolisms. Previous lecture was mostly about the type of photosynthesis or photoautotrophy as done by cyanobacteria. Now at this point, I would like to talk about a particular community, one of many that I could have chosen, but one that I've decided to focus in on a little bit, that displays at least five types of metabolisms, each of which I will explain and try to put into to context, and that I think might be accessible to many people who might choose to go out and examine such an environment themselves firsthand. It is a sulfur-rich environment. For example, it could be a sulfur spring. It could be the estuary where salt water and fresh water are coming together along a shoreline. It could be low tide sand flats or mud flats along a shoreline. And there are a number of other sulfur-rich environments as well. And in fact, all you need to do to know that you are in a sulfur-rich environment is to smell the sulfur. And what you're essentially smelling there is a gaseous form of sulfur, H2S, hydrogen sulfide. So what I want to do is take us to an imaginary ideal mud flat, ideal in that it's going to be relatively easy for us to see all five of our metabolisms in one little spot. In reality, you would be going to your sulfide or hydrogen sulfide rich environment where you can smell some sulfur and maybe doing a little more careful searching around and analyzing, realizing that you might not see all the types of metabolisms all in one tidy little place. So this is an ideal mud flat, but let's take it as an example. And smell the hydrogen sulfide and realize at the beginning that that's a poisonous gas. You're smelling a poisonous gas, a gas that is as toxic to you and to your metabolism as cyanide is. And the difference between hydrogen sulfide and cyanide is that we are sensitive to extremely tiny amounts of hydrogen sulfide, so that the amount you're smelling is just scarce parts per million in the air, not enough in an open space to do any harm to you. But it is useful to realize that it's a highly reactive gas and therefore toxic, and able to get itself involved in our own metabolism in a way that if you were in a confined space with hydrogen sulfide, it would certainly be a poisonous gas for you. And that's the basics of this entire community that I'm going to describe to you, because sometimes extremely active gases go hand in hand with toxicity in large quantities, but in small quantities, that extreme reactivity just means that they're wonderful gases for use in metabolism. So I next want to talk about hydrogen sulfide in an entirely positive way. It's what these organisms are using to do what they do for the most part. A lot of this metabolism is based on using hydrogen sulfide, which I will point out as often as I can. So let's say we're at our ideal mud flat. One of the things that makes it ideal, by the way, is it's not at a public beach or in a section of a public beach where people are tromping all over it. Secluded is good, and a place where the waves are not chopping at it is good. And a place where the tide goes way, way out and the water gets very, very shallow and very, very still is good. So again, you're choosing carefully, and there should be a little bit of a smell of sulfur in a nice way in the air. And the first thing you might be fortunate enough to see is the felt-like mats of cyanobacteria, the cyanos we were talking about in the previous lecture. And I say felt-like in the sense of if you were to take some dryer lint and kind of mat it together in your hands, you would make a sort of a felt. And that's really the consistency of these mats. Now, what color are they going to be? Probably blackish to brownish, because these cyanos are out in the blazing sun for the most part and are going to be using their camouflage colors or their sunglasses colors to protect their major photosynthetic pigment, which is chlorophyll. But they are going to be on the surface. These are our surface photosynthesizers. And you may also be lucky enough to see little bubbles of oxygen in amongst the felt-like texture of this mat of cyanobacteria. And that is their waste product. That bubbling oxygen is their field mark, one of their waste products, the one that essentially was the greatest pollution event ever to have occurred on Earth, all of the oxygen that has been accumulating from the activities of cyanobacterial photosynthesis. One of the nice things about seeing cyanobacteria in this context is if you put your ear very, very close to that felt-like mat with the bubbling oxygen, it sounds like champagne effervescing. So it's one of the auditory field marks of bacteria as well. You can actually hear the bubbles being formed, especially if you are in an area where the tide is coming back in and is about to recover an area of mats that has been temporarily high and dry. Now, underneath that layer of cyanobacteria, we'll scrape it away very, very gently, just a millimeter or two down. Don't scrape too much. Just a little brush of your hand sometimes is sufficient. If we're lucky, we're going to see a beautiful pinkish purple scum of another type of bacterium. Now, sometimes there are circumstances where this pinkish purple scum will be up on the surface. It will be the first thing that you see. Those are situations in which you ought to be smelling quite a bit of sulfide in the air. That would be a situation where sulfide was especially abundant for some reason. But ordinarily, you're going to gently move aside that layer of cyanobacteria, and right beneath will be the most beautiful purple and pink scum. Let me tell you what these bacteria are. They are purple sulfur bacteria. They are of the proteobacteria. They are photosynthesizers or photoautotrophs. And let me briefly remind you what the equation was for the cyanobacteria so I can contrast it with the purple sulfur bacteria, because these are two major kinds of photosynthesis or photoautotrophy. Recall that the cyanobacteria were taking water and carbon dioxide and using the energy of the sun to make sugar and oxygen as a waste product. What the purple sulfur bacteria are doing is taking hydrogen sulfide instead of H2O, which is water, hydrogen sulfide plus carbon dioxide with the energy of the sun making sugar. And now what's their waste product? Their waste product is sulfur. So think about H2O and H2S, the starting compounds of those two types of photosynthesis. On one hand, we're starting with an oxygen-rich compound, that's H2O or water. On the other hand, we're starting with a sulfur-rich compound, that's H2S, the starting compound for the purple sulfurs. So we're getting two different waste products out the other end. What's interesting about the two waste products is they both got their challenges. On one hand, oxygen is toxic. On the other hand, it diffuses away. So as soon as it's released, it's gone. It's gone into the atmosphere, and it's gone away from the organism that has just produced it. The problem with sulfur is that it lingers on as a solid, and fortunately it can be used by other organisms, but there are some interesting issues that can come up with those organisms that must temporarily store sulfur as a waste product, because it's not necessarily a convenient thing to be storing. But nonetheless, we have organisms that end up storing that waste product. It does not necessarily readily diffuse away. So that summarizes the second major type of bacterial metabolism. It's the hydrogen sulfide using photoautotrophy that the purple sulfurs are doing. By the way, where's their chlorophyll? They have chlorophyll, but they have much more of a purple or pink pigment that obscures your view of their chlorophyll and gives them a predominantly purple or pink color. But trust me, they have chlorophyll there. All photosynthesizers have green chlorophyll somewhere in their cells. These just happen to have predominantly other pigments that you can see. And there's a really interesting reason for that I'm going to get into in just a couple of minutes. But next, let's gently brush away that pink purple scum layer and get down to a delicate dark green film, which is our third layer down. And this is if we're lucky. If this film is visible, then we'll get to talk about it. This is an ideal mud flat. It might not be present in whatever mud flat you're looking at. If we see it, if we see that dark green layer below the purple layer, we are looking at green sulfur bacteria. And they are doing approximately the same equation that I just described for the purple sulfur bacteria. That is, they're taking hydrogen sulfide, carbon dioxide, using the light of the sun to make sugar in giving off a sulfur waste product. So let me explain a little bit further what's going on with that pigmentation, with those three layers in particular. It's something that you can see actually in a different section of the beach, perhaps. And so this is a good analogy, and this is if you're trying to describe this or think about this, it might be okay to turn away from the microbial mat for just a minute and to look over at an area where you can see big seaweeds or big algae or big plant-like photosynthesizers, huge multicellular things, maybe clinging to the rocks, maybe clinging to some bit of debris. Take a look at those, and if you can find a rock that has lots of bright green seaweed around the top, followed by lots of brownish seaweeds a little bit further down, followed by more reddish-brown seaweeds even further down, and then imagine that rock, which presumably is high and dry because you're at low tide, imagine that rock covered by some amount of water such that light can get down to the top layers of the rock more easily than down to the next layers, down the sides, and even less easily down to the depths where the rock is attached to the bottom. What you're seeing is a zonation of seaweeds with different pigments that are taking advantage of the different wavelengths of light that can get down through the water. Turns out that blue wavelengths of light get more easily down into the depths of the water than red wavelengths of light. And I'll just use blue and red as the example. We could actually take the entire color spectrum and talk about what each wavelength does in respect to getting through water, but blue and red are a good compare and contrast. So that the seaweeds that are up highest on the rock, the bright green ones, are receiving more of a full spectrum of light and are doing more like what land plants do. They're bright green, they've got their chlorophylls displayed, and they're doing a kind of photosynthesis that can take full advantage of the spectrum of light that's coming in. The seaweeds that are in the lower zones along the edge of the rock must use accessory pigments in brownish and yellowish and reddish colors to take up whatever wavelengths of light they can manage to get and to pass that light on to their other metabolizing molecules. It turns out that red wavelengths of light don't get very deep into the water. You know this if you've ever had a red bathing suit and gone deep into the water and noticed that the red color fades away. Red color seems to disappear. Or if you've ever been in some sort of submersible vessel where you've been looking at your clothing in the light of deep water, then you might notice that the reds seem to disappear. So this is a challenge for seaweeds, and it's a challenge for the purple and green sulfur bacteria. And so it's why these different layers, whether we're talking about seaweeds or talking about these layers of bacteria, are so different. They're actually taking advantage of whatever they can get of the light that is descending down through these depths. And the lower you go, the more you lose some of the crucial wavelengths of light, and the more you've got to make up for it with some extra pigments. Now, the next layer of bacteria is represented by black, often black or very dark sediments with a strong sulfury smell that lie just below the layer of green sulfurs. And this is the layer where a group of heterotrophs called the sulfate reducers reside. And they have some very prominent field marks, but first, let me linger on that word heterotrophy. They are heterotrophs just like us. That is, they are food eaters just like us. They do not generate their own food. But they have a couple of interesting differences. So I'm going to compare our metabolism with their metabolism so that you can get a feel for what the difference, what the primary difference is. Here's what we're doing. We're taking in sugar and we're taking in oxygen. And by the way, sugar represents all food, so I don't mean that our diet consists entirely of sugar. I'm using sugar as a representational food molecule. You could be taking in steak. You could be taking in corn on the cob. You could be taking in all sorts of things, but sugar is going to represent all possible foods. We're taking in sugar. We are taking in oxygen with every single breath we take. We are then processing that sugar and breaking it down into its smallest component parts. And we are giving out as waste products water and carbon dioxide. Now, I'm going to review that again in a moment, but let me tell you what we get out of that. When we break down the sugar, we are releasing the energy in the chemical bonds that was holding together that sugar. And if we're doing this right, we are taking that energy and incorporating it into other chemical bonds that we will be able to use ourselves for all sorts of things. So we're essentially taking chemical energy from our food. That's our process of metabolism. That's what it means to be a heterotroph. Now, let me dissect this just a little bit more so that you can see why the particular waste products that we have make some sense for us. We're taking sugar, and I'll remind you that it is C6H12O6. So here are the C's, here are the H's, and here are the O's there. Okay. Then, inexplicably, oxygen. Okay, and I will explain that eventually, but right now it should seem a little strange to you. What are we doing without oxygen? Why do we need to take in oxygen? I mean, the sugar makes sense. It's rich with carbons and rich with hydrogens. It's terribly useful. It's full of wonderful bonds. What's going on with the oxygen? Okay, so we're going to take that C6H12O6 with the oxygen. We're going to take it in through a complicated set of reactions that I won't go into. We're going to carefully take that sugar apart, and we're going to end up with the C's and the H's and the O's all kind of rearranged into much, much smaller molecules. And that's how we get the H2O, and that's how we get the CO2. We're down to pretty much the smallest molecules that we can conveniently make out of those much larger food molecules that we started with. That's what we're doing. That's what lots and lots and lots of bacteria are doing. That's what fungi are doing. That's what animals in general are doing. So that's a really universal sort of activity that is a type of heterotrophy. Here's what the sulfate reducers are doing. Remember I said the sulfate reducers are just like us, except they've got another little thing going on. They're taking sugar. And where are they getting that sugar, by the way? Well, guess what? They're just underneath three layers of photosynthesizers that are making sugar in abundance and making it in excess. So it's actually very convenient for them to be right underneath this wonderful source of food making that is the activity just over their heads. So they're taking sugar and they're taking sulfate, SO4, sulfate, instead of oxygen. And they're processing that sugar, and in the end, they're making hydrogen sulfide as a waste product. Hydrogen sulfide, which is what you smelled when you first approached this microbial mat. So their waste product is the smell of a microbial mat, and is the smell of an estuary, and is the smell of any kind of sulfury smell in the air. They're the ones that are making the hydrogen sulfide. And can you see this a little cycle there? Because we had sulfur and sulfate as well as the waste products of the purple and green sulfur bacteria that are just over the heads of these sulfate reducers. And these sulfate reducers are now taking that sulfate, taking that sugar, and they're ending up with hydrogen sulfide, gaseous hydrogen sulfide, as a waste instead of water. Notice the parallel between hydrogen sulfide, H2S, and water, H2O. Now, we've just completed a little sulfur cycle. And that's one of the wonderful things about these little sulfur-rich communities is they're handing sulfur around to each other as though it were valuable, because it is. But the other thing to notice is that there's a big oxygen right in the middle of sulfate. So just as we're using oxygen for something that we haven't described yet, these sulfate reducers are using SO4. They've got some oxygen in there too. So something is going on with oxygen with this type of metabolism, something that needs explaining and something that will be explained. First, though, let me tell you about a different type of autotrophy that can be observed here, and then I'll go back to the whole oxygen question, which is somewhat complicated. There's yet another type of metabolism going on in this microbial mat that we've been describing. We've had the cyanobacteria, we've had the purple sulfur bacteria, the green sulfur bacteria, we've had the sulfate-reducing heterotrophs, and we have one final type of metabolism that can be highly visible in such an environment. We're back up onto the surface, and we're looking at scums and slimes, something cobwebby in some cases, almost as though a cobweb has been draped over things a little bit, of white bacteria that can sometimes be on the surface of the cyanobacteria, sometimes can be on the surface of some black sediment that's become exposed. So look for it almost everywhere that you're looking, as you're looking around for these other bacteria, in any kind of creamy or bright white color that looks slimy or scummy or cobwebby. What you're looking at there is a wonderful group of bacteria called the sulfur oxidizers. And what's really exciting about them is that these are among the chemoautotrophs, which I alluded to previously. These are the organisms that can make their own sugar using nothing more than the bonds in chemicals. And it's an amazing thing to do because it means they can live in total blackness and yet still make sugar. And that has some interesting connotations that I'm going to get to in just a moment. But first, let me describe what their metabolism is and compare it and contrast it to metabolisms that we've already been talking about. Let's say that we were to compare and contrast them with purple sulfur bacteria. So purple sulfur bacteria are taking hydrogen sulfide and carbon dioxide, using the energy of the sun to make sugars and to release sulfur and sulfate as wastes. What sulfur oxidizers are doing is they're taking hydrogen sulfide, using the bonds that are holding together the hydrogen sulfide, because there are chemical bonds holding it together, not many, but there are some, taking those bonds that are holding the hydrogen sulfide together, taking that energy from those bonds, taking carbon dioxide, and amazingly making sugar. It really is amazing, amazingly making sugar. No sunlight needed whatsoever, and as a waste product, making sulfur. And by the way, that's why they look so creamy white. They actually store their sulfur waste for a while. So you're actually seeing the bright, creamy white of what elemental sulfur can look like when it's being stored in a tiny bacterium. And that's what gives them their color. Absolutely no photosynthetic pigments. Now, it's true, they're out on the surface as though they were photosynthesizers, but most of the chemoautotrophs, including these sulfur oxidizers, live in total blackness, out of sight of us, out of access. So these are some of the more accessible ones, the ones that we can get a chance to look at. The vast majority of them are deep under the oceans and deep in sediments. One really, really famous group of chemoautotrophs is in the Pacific Rift Vent Zone, where I previously described an amazing community of organisms, all depending on these particular types of bacteria with this really unusual metabolism. It really surprised scientists who saw it for the first time when they went down in a research submersible to find out what was in these Pacific Rift Zones. To their enormous surprise, it was a whole community of large invertebrates, including gigantic worms and enormous but white crabs and shrimp and all sorts of enormous clams. And what could possibly be supporting this community when it's so far down in the ocean? We're so far below the photic zone where most sugars are being produced. The answer turns out to be chemoautotrophs by the trillions, you know, in any given community or any given part of a community. And all sorts of interesting connotations for what these invertebrates are like. First of all, they tend to be without color, so it's a ghostly-looking community. The very pale clams, very pale crustaceans, very pale worms, with one really striking exception, really startling exception, that is many, many of them have bright red hemoglobin. Just like our hemoglobin, just like our bright red molecule that carries oxygen around in our bloodstream. But these invertebrates are using this hemoglobin for a very different reason. Turns out many of them are in intimate symbioses with chemoautotrophs. So they've taken these valuable bacteria that can make sugar in darkness and taken them up into their own tissues and are cultivating them as little food factories. It makes an enormous amount of sense. But there's something about this reaction that is damaged by presence of oxygen. Oxygen is not a good addition to this particular reaction that these bacteria are trying to carry out. And so the purpose of the hemoglobin is to keep oxygen away from the reactions that these bacteria are trying to do. So it means this community is just a whole different ecology that has been fascinating biologists for the last, 20 or 30 years. And there's more and more to find out about these intimate relationships between the chemoautotrophs and the invertebrates of this community. Now, there's another venue that's very exciting where these chemoautotrophs are being evoked as something worth studying, and that is in the whole emerging field of searching for life on other planets and moons of other planets. For example, the moons of Jupiter that are being explored right now and that turn out to have all sorts of interesting properties. One of the things that exobiologists or astrobiologists have been thinking very hard about is what sorts of organisms should we be looking for when we're looking for life on other planets. Now, of course, there's the whole school of thought that it will be something like E.T. from the movie, and it will be somehow shaped like us, and perhaps we'll be capable of sending out radio waves that we could pick up somehow. But there's another whole school of thought, one that I tend to favor, and that is we should be looking at some sort of bacterial-like activity. And the whole chemoautotrophic type of metabolism really helps us through a situation where you have a planet that might be icy cold on its surface but molten in its interior, and there must be some place between icy cold and molten that is of some reasonable temperature where there might be liquid water, and yet you're far below the photic zone, you're deep inside of the planet presumably. What could possibly be living down there? Well, it's why chemoautotrophs are so interesting to these planetary biologists or astrobiologists. They're a fascinating type of metabolism that makes possible some scenarios that they enjoy thinking about. It's still a very much of an ongoing subject, but you will find them often in reference to thinking about how we ought to be thinking about the possibilities of extraterrestrial life. By the way, I'm going to finish this lecture by coming back to ourselves. I began this set of lectures for this course with talking about how anomalous we are, how enormous we are, how multicellular we are, how terrestrial we are. And that was all presented as is why our particular point of view is challenging for really understanding the bacteria and seeing the bacteria. But now I want to come around again and talk about how all of that is actually due to bacteria. Our enormous size, our multicellularity, our terrestrial way of life, all of that is a part of us and is a part of the problem with our point of view sometimes, is due to bacteria. It's thanks to bacteria. So I want to go back briefly to the timeline that I've been talking about through this entire course, the 4 billion year timeline. I want to go back to that point at 2.5 billion years ago, where I said all sorts of exciting symbioses were occurring and where complex, larger cells were evolving that would eventually come into the lineages that would be plants and animals and fungi and protists, including ourselves in those lineages. And one of the symbioses that occurred is that bacteria, who could take food and oxygen and metabolize it very efficiently and produce as waste products carbon dioxide and water, which is just what we do, those bacteria came on board as symbionts and became our mitochondria, became our specialized cell structures called mitochondria that are where our metabolism occurs. So our metabolism, the food, the oxygen, the production of carbon dioxide and water, is entirely due to our mitochondria, which are symbiotic bacteria from way back. They still have vestiges of their DNA from when they were free-living organisms. And by the way, they were free-living bacteria of the proteobacteria. So we're carrying around proteobacteria with us that still have little remnants of their genome. That's how come we get to metabolize the way we do. But there's a little more. I promised to say something about what was going on with oxygen because on one hand, I've been talking about it as a toxic molecule, which it is. But on the other hand, I've been acknowledging, as I should, that it's absolutely essential for those heterotrophs that have incorporated oxygen into their metabolism. Clearly, we need oxygen. If you try to hold your breath and not use any oxygen for 6 minutes, you'll find yourself in some great difficulty. So clearly, oxygen is doing something essential. But what? If you look at the simple equation, it does not seem to be doing much of anything. So let me evoke an image for you that might help to explain in a sort of a visual way why oxygen is so important to us. And then let me connect that up with us being such enormous, anomalous organisms. It's all going to be connected up as a sort of a conclusion to this lecture. Imagine an assembly line. Because that actually is what metabolism ends up looking like. We've been skipping over the actual nitty-gritty of each and every chemical reaction that has to occur. But imagine that that set of chemical reactions has the look of an assembly line, so that some product is starting at the beginning and is being converted and converted and converted and converted all the way down the length of the assembly line till we get some waste, something that's going to be taken away as a waste product. Okay, and that's typical metabolism for any organism and the exact reactions that are going on in that assembly line. I'm not going to go into descriptions about. I'm going to say, though, that that assembly line is going to work most efficiently if we keep it moving. That's obvious. That would be true for a factory assembly line, too. And in fact, imagine a factory assembly line in which something is going wrong and the assembly line is being stopped in one place or another such that the product is not being moved along. That's the kind of problem I'm talking about. And then finally, the ultimate problem that can occur in an assembly line is that whatever it is that's coming out the other end is not whisked away or taken away efficiently. And again, if you want to imagine a factory assembly line, imagine that it's whatever product coming out the other end is not being boxed up and hauled away, and you're getting a pile, and then you're getting a larger pile, and then you're getting an enormous pile, and by, you've actually stopped the progress of the assembly line. So here, at last, is what's going on with oxygen. And what's going on with oxygen is that we have cleverly, deep in our evolutionary roots, used it both to detoxify it and to keep our metabolism rolling along in the assembly line. Okay, watch what we do. Let's say that a major thing coming down the assembly line is electrons. And you just need to trust me on that because I'm not going to get into the chemical equations that will, you know, completely clinch that. But let's say it's a whole bunch of electrons coming down the assembly line. At the end, I need to take away a certain number of electrons. And what we essentially do is we take some oxygen, we take some hydrogen, we take a few of those extra electrons that are coming down the line, and we tack it all together and make water. Remember, water is H2O. So I've just got that oxygen, I've got some extra electrons that I'm going to take away from the end of the assembly line, and I've got hydrogen, and I'm going to build myself an H2O. I'm going to build myself a water out of that. What's wonderful about water, it is completely untoxic. In fact, it's even beneficial. There's no remnant of any kind of dangerous form of oxygen left there. It's a completely benign oxygen attached to two hydrogens at this point. The cell can use it, or it can diffuse away easily, and we keep the assembly line moving. We keep those electrons being used. That's how come we're using oxygen. And that's what these sulfate reducers, by the way, are doing with their sulfate. They're using it at the end of an assembly line to nab up those extra electrons that were not being used otherwise and making a product that is then going to be whisked away, we hope. Now, it turns out that this kind of oxygen-using heterotrophy is extremely efficient. It's a wonderful way to get every last bit of energy possible out of a big sugar molecule. So it turns out that the bigger you get, The more complicated you get, the more you get completely dependent on that energy. So I'm going to bring us full circle to who we are. We are enormous organisms, multicellular, wonderfully complex, with big brains, by the way, that use up an enormous amount of sugar and oxygen. And we cannot live more than 6 minutes without oxygen, so it's obviously very essential. It's thanks to our original bacteria that we acquired 2.5 billion years ago that can do this amazing kind of metabolism that is so efficient that we're allowed to be as big as we are, and why it's not optional anymore for us. There are plenty of tiny organisms for which this particular kind of metabolism is optional. In other words, some days, if they've got oxygen, they'll do the assembly line efficiently. Other days, if there's no oxygen, the assembly line will get a little backed up, and it doesn't make much of a difference. They're tiny organisms, and they're not doing a whole lot, but we now have an obligate relationship with the bacteria that we're carrying around, the mitochondria, to do this particular kind of metabolism and to have an abundance of oxygen. So that concludes the major part of this course. And in the next concluding lecture, I'd like to do a little recapping of some major topics and also maybe to introduce some ideas for what I call future directions with this whole topic of bacteria. And I also want to especially remind you that a goal for me in this course, and it's also a personal goal of my own, is to incorporate more and more of an understanding of bacteria in my own nature studies. And I'm hoping that I've left you with some ideas about doing that as well.
This ends Lecture 13.